You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow, Brandon
Sanderson, Robin Mobb,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Abby Wexler.
Thanks for tuning into Author Stories. We've got a great show lined up for you today. Be sure to go to HankGarner.com and subscribe to the show. No matter how you listen, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, Pandora, Spotify, or YouTube, you can subscribe to the show and never miss an episode. I'd like to thank some sponsors today. Scribophile is a respectful online writing workshop and writers community. Writers of all skill levels join to improve each other's work with thoughtful critiques and by sharing their writing experiences. We're the writing group to join if you want to find beta readers, get the best feedback around, learn how to get published, and be a part of the friendliest and most successful writing workshop online. Improve your writing by receiving detailed critiques. Learn from a vast collection of free writing resources. Make lifelong friends in our busy community of writers. Writing is a solitary art, but that doesn't mean you have to be lonely. Lucky for you, there are thousands of writers on Scribophile every day, and we're a really friendly bunch. You've never seen a writing group like this one. Join Scribophile today at scribophile.community. For the Words is a unique writing motivator unlike anything I've seen. For the Words is an online writing platform which motivates writers of all backgrounds to increase their word count through gamification. Writing can be challenging, especially when you need to consistently produce a high output of words. By injecting a little fun into the routine and using daily rewards to promote a healthy writing habit, For the Words makes it easier to reach that word count. We're a community of bloggers, professional authors, college and high school students, research scientists, gamers, and first-time writers from all over the world. Come for the words, stay for the fun. Go to thewords.com. Both Sides of the Law, the Casper Halliday NYPD series, book one by Nathan Roden. He shared his father's dream of becoming a detective. A prison sentence was not part of his plan. Casper Halliday's dream began to unravel 2 months before his 16th birthday. His father, Bobby, resigned from the NYPD after 15 years without an explanation. Casper's parents fought. Sirens closed in on their home from every direction. The sound that had always been a source of comfort now brought only humiliation. Bobby Halliday moved out. Casper's dream dissolved into a daily fight for survival. All he wanted now was to finish high school so he could ease his mother's burden. On his 17th birthday, in the throes of depression, Casper made a bad decision. That decision brought him face to face with one of the most dangerous men in the city. In Casper's world, there is laughter and there are tears. There's light and there's bitter darkness. There are improbable friends and unspeakable enemies. The Casper Halliday NYPD series launches with the most unlikely of beginnings. Read Both Sides of the Law today. The ebook edition includes a sneak peek of Ghost Man, book two in the series. Writers, the internet is one of the best tools for research and creativity. It can also be one of the biggest hindrances to productivity, distracting you from doing the seat in the chair, hand on keyboard work. Rescue Time gives you an accurate picture of how you spend your time to help you become more productive every single day. Spot inefficiencies in your day and become better at managing your time. Create a goal like spending less than 1 hour per day on email to help you stay focused. Set an alarm to tell you when you spent more than 2 hours on Facebook. Try Rescue Time and use our special discount code for 30% off a Rescue Time premium account by going to rescuetime.com/authorstories. Let us help you rescue your time. Before we get into our show with Lauren Meckling, we have an audio excerpted courtesy Penguin Random House audio from How Could She by Lauren Meckling, narrated by Brittany Presley. Thanks for listening. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Abby Waxman back on the show. She was with us last year, and we were talking about other people's houses, her previous book. And this year, she's got a fantastic new book called The Bookish Life of Nina Hill. And it is hilarious and poignant and all of the things that you come to expect from an Abby Waxman book. Welcome back to the show, Abby.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be back.
Abby, last time we talked about your first memory of wanting to be a writer, as we open every show, and you told us about not exactly knowing a specific moment, but just being surrounded by writers, and your mother and your father and your grandfather all plying the trade, if you will, and it just kind of felt like a normal thing for people to do. And I think you even joked about that if your father had been a car mechanic or something, you probably would have gone into that, because it's just what was surrounding you. With your third novel out now, have those feelings changed for you? Do you still feel like this is your calling, your natural vocation?
For sure, partially because I'm completely incapable of doing anything else. Terrible work ethic. I am lazy. I don't like to get dressed. It's not just that I love to write, which I do. It's that the whole gestalt of being a writer works for me. It enables me to live the rest of my life, you know, in blissful peace.
That's so funny. So what's been happening the last year? The last book was hilarious and also made us really take a look at what it means to live in community with one another and the kind of the big and small of how we interact with people around us. And the new book is kind of takes a different view, but how has the last year been, and how was the last book received?
It did okay. I think people, what was the strangest reaction to it? People were bothered by how much swearing there was in it, which was really surprising to me. So I was like, oh. They were like, yes, I like this book, but there was so much bad language, I couldn't finish it. And I was like, oh, that's unfortunate.
Have you lived in the world lately?
I know, but, you know, I guess some people just don't swear, you know, and it's fine. And the beauty of it was that my mother, bless her cotton socks, had said to me when she read an early draft, there's too much swearing in this book, Abby. You've got to take out at least 99% of all these words. And I was like, no, that's how people talk. That's how I talk. That's how everybody talks. And I asked my agent and I asked the publisher, and the publisher asked other people at the publishing house, and everyone was like, no, it's fine. And then when it got out, you know, it didn't come up a lot. I mean, it did very well and people were very nice about it. But when people didn't like it, that's what they didn't like. And so my mother has been able to say, I told you so, which, you know, is obviously makes her happy. And, you know, and now I have to listen more carefully to everything she tells me. So
that's good. So funny.
It's fine. There's no swearing in Nina Hill.
Oh, that's so funny. You know, that really brings up the subject of, you know, criticism and critics. And the book can be, a fantastic read. It can really explore deep societal issues and something like that on the surface turns someone off. And what's funny, as a writer, those things stick out in our minds, and it may be three or four reviews out of 100 that mention that, but those are the three or four that stick, you know, at the top of your mind. How do you, as a writer, learn to deal with criticism and to brush those things off and continue to be you without letting people affect the way that you do what you do?
Well, first of all, you're completely right. The half dozen negative reviews I've gotten of all of my books are the ones that I think about. You know, they're the ones that I am like, okay, what can I do? I mean, generally speaking, I think actually that the simplest answer is that I worked in advertising for, you know, nearly 20 years, and that inures you to criticism. I mean, basically, you spend your time working to a deadline on someone and trying to create someone else's voice, and then people come along and, you know, poop all over it, and you have to go and do it again. And you get very used to just hearing people say, yeah, that's not, that doesn't work, you need to do it again, without even giving you a reason, and just being like, okay, and then you just go do it again. And so that is an enormously good way to develop a thick skin, and also to sort of separate a little bit from your work, you know. So it's much different when it's novels than it is when it's advertising copy, right? Because I actually care about my novels, whereas I didn't care so much about IBM or whoever I was writing about. Not that I didn't love IBM, don't get me wrong, of course they're wonderful, but you know, it was what I was getting paid to do. Yes, this is what I'm getting paid to do, but I would write it whether I was getting paid or not. You know, this is a more personal thing. But still, when I get negative, I tend to giggle. Like, I'm mostly just sort of mildly embarrassed that somehow I missed the mark. And I giggle when they get really annoyed. Like, I've had a couple of reviews. I had one where this woman, I can't remember exactly, but she went on for like many, many paragraphs about how much she hated, I think it was other people's houses, and probably because of the swearing, but also she's like, if you want to read a book that has, you know, piss poor character development and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, she really ripped into it. And I was just, I thought it was hilarious. Like, I was like, this is, I can't believe she's getting so worked up about it. And then, but spending so much time, right? You know, because I just can't, if I don't like something, I'm not going to, I can't be bothered to go write a negative review. Okay, I'm not, I'm just not that person. So I'm much more likely to say something positive. I was raised, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all, right? So that's where I come from. So if I hate something, I'm more likely to just pretend it never happened, or just to not finish the book. You know, if I start a book and I don't like it, I stop. It's not a big deal. So I wrote, I wrote back to her, which I don't normally do. And I was like, I'm really sorry that you didn't like the book. Thank you for taking the time to share your thoughts. And, you know, what a boring world it would be if we all liked the same stuff. And, you know, hopefully your review will help people who wouldn't enjoy the book avoid it. You know, I mean, like, I don't want people to read the book and not like it. I want people, you know, if other people know, for example, that they hate bad language and that it's going to put them off, then they should avoid that book like the plague.
Right.
You know, because there's loads of bad language. And I don't need them to read it. And I think that's what it comes down to. I love it when people love the books, and I feel really fortunate and grateful when readers write to me or text me and say, I really loved your book. It's awesome. It's the best. It's the very best feeling ever. It's great. But similarly, if they don't like it, there's nothing I can do about it. And it doesn't matter, because there's so many books. It's just go read something else.
Well,
so,
what?
Yeah.
What's funny is that the book is so full of sarcasm and kind of biting wit it kind of couldn't be written any other way. I don't think. I don't think I would have been as immersed in the story if it was written any other way. It seemed natural. It seemed like the story that it was. And, you know, and the 5-star reviews way outweigh any negativity, and people are crying that the story's over and all of that. But, sometimes a book is just for you at a certain time, and sometimes it's not.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's okay. You know, it's not, it doesn't reflect on the book. It's just the fit between the book and you. So I try not to take it personally. But note that those are the reviews I can quote.
Exactly.
I try not to take it personally.
Right.
And yet, you know, they're seared into my very soul. Yeah.
Well, that was a fun side tangent that I didn't necessarily mean to go on, but I think that's for somebody out there that maybe is dealing with criticism and you helped them to navigate those waters. But the new book is so much fun, and it is an interesting look at kind of the opposite side of the coin. It's called The Bookish Life of Nina Hill. Who is Nina Hill, and how did she come into your life?
So Nina actually sort of arrived fully formed. I was touring, it sounds like it was a big rock star thing. I went to like half a dozen bookstores to promote the last book. And
did you have
them,
a smoke machine?
I didn't, but God, that we should add that.
We should
get a smoke machine and like a tiny Stonehenge. so they were all these there were all these girls working at these bookstores, these independent bookstores, and they were all broadly, I mean, obviously very different people, but they had these big broad similarities, which were they were millennials. They were really into books, like deeply into books, and had read, you know, everything and wanted to talk about it. And they were really into movies, and they were really into TV, and they were really into popular culture, and they were just really smart, interesting young women. And they wore like really cool vintage clothing and excellent shoes. And I was like, I'm going to write about you. I'm going to write about you collectively. And so Nina is sort of an amalgamation of all of those young women and the many millennial young women that I know in my personal life. So
the Nina is a self-proclaimed introvert. In this age of social media, it probably is broadcast more often, and maybe that's why it seems to be more prevalent. But I know lots of people that call themselves introverts, and it's the popular thing now to talk about how much you don't like other people or just like to be alone. And there seems to be an inordinate amount of book lovers that are in that camp. Did you learn anything about introverts in writing this book or communicating with these people that inspired Nina for you?
I think here's the thing. I feel pretty. I have many introverts in my family. I am actually kind of neutral personally. Like I'm neither introverted nor extroverted. Like I can go out and hang out with other people. But generally speaking, you know, for me, the true definition of an introvert is someone who gains energy from being alone and expends energy when they're with other people, right? So if I'm out socially, that's definitely more tiring, and being at home and reading a book is definitely more energizing to me. So I started sort of from that point, and I have many other introverts in my family. And I also feel quite strongly that introverts, even though it is more talked about now and people seem are proud to be introverted, which is great, still extroverts dominate the conversation because they're the ones who, you know, take the microphone and make the conversation.
Right.
So, you know, but I feel very strongly that introverts are not failed extroverts. You know, they are a totally different thing with their own complexities and subtleties of personality. They're just quieter about it. And I also wanted to write a character who was both introverted and confident. Because those are the two things that people find difficult to reconcile. You know, that someone who prefers to be alone or who finds being social tiring isn't when they're sitting at home being super shy and anxious and nervous. No, they just prefer to be on their own. So Nina is fully confident in herself. She has a love life. She has book clubs. She has trivia. She just doesn't enjoy being extroverted. She prefers to stay home. And so I wanted to write about that kind of person.
Well, I think that's a great point when you said that introverts are not necessarily failed extroverts. And I think that's the common reaction from extroverts is that, well, you're just not a nice person. You just don't like people. And, you know, you're just being, you know, spoiled or whatever. But there are people grumpy. That's a great word. Yeah, I mean, people are just different. We're just made differently, yeah. And we should, you know, learn to appreciate, you know, all of our friends and family for the way they are. We all add something to the conversation.
For sure. And it's just that introverts aren't yelling about it just because because they're introverts, right? I saw a great T-shirt that said, "Introverts unite separately and in our own homes." So I think that is part of the problem is that, you know, introverts are not great organizers or joiners, particularly because it's just not what, you know, floats their boat. Whereas
right.
Extroverts are out there going, let's get together and, you know, do something.
Right.
And we need both, right? If everyone was out yelling all the time, no one would be able to hear anyone. So
exactly.
We need both.
Nina is... It's kind of a celebration of bookish life. I remember one of my greatest dreams would be to own an independent bookstore where we would have old used books and new books, and my greatest dream would be, you know, turning people on to new books or things that they had not discovered. And I never got that dream, but I do a podcast where, you know, we talk to, you know, hundreds of thousands of people every week, and we tell them about new authors and new books. And it's kind of a fulfillment of that same dream, but just in a very different way. But, you know, this kind of guilty pleasures for writers are books about writers or books about bookstores and things like that. There's something just kind of giddy about writing about the things that got us wanting to be writers in the first place. Was writing the story kind of one of those fun explorations of the thing that you had dedicated your life to?
Yes. And also and at the same time, the same nerve-wracking, you know, process of creating a book where you're not sure that you're managing to do it very well. It's been described as a love letter to bookworms, and it is, because, you know, the great thing about being a writer, it turns out, is readers, right? It's really wonderful to hear from readers, and most people are extremely nice and enthusiastic and supportive of writers, for which I'm enormously grateful. And I wanted to sort of give back a little bit without sounding ridiculous, and just sort of celebrate all of the characteristics that make us the bookish among us the way we are. You know, I actually feel like it's more, the generation of millennials is much more open about their love for books than I was as a kid. Like, it was not cool when I was 14 or 15 to talk about books particularly. But the millennials grew up with Harry Potter, which I think is the big difference. So Harry Potter came along and they all got very, very, very excited, and it was very, very public. And it was suddenly cool to talk about how much you love these books, and they would line up when a new book came out, and they went to the movies, and they, you know what I mean? It was like a whole identifying experience that was pivotal in their childhoods. And so I think as they've grown up, they've retained that lack of embarrassment when it comes to talking about how much they love books or writers. Like, they're totally ready to talk about, you know, I love YA, or I love romance, or I love mysteries, or I love contemporary fiction. They're just less snobby about books. Books are still cool to them. And, you know, I just think that's great. You know, I just think that generation, I just like them. I like millennials a lot. I think they get a bad rap.
Well, speaking of millennials, and I have a house full of millennial kids, or just under millennial, whatever that other distinction is.
Gen Z, next one, yeah.
Gen Z, yeah. So, but yeah, there's a lot of overlap between them. How did you kind of connect with this generation? What kind of research did you do, or you know, maybe informal research to get a feel for what they are truly thinking, instead of just writing, you know, from someone who's, you know, Gen X, like I am, right, and then trying to portray them, you know, how do you go about connecting with them realistically and honestly, so that you get that across in the book? Because your characters are not, you don't look down on them. I'll put it that way.
No, I like them all. Well, I'm very lucky. I have, because my kids are now heavenly 17, 15, and 12. So I'm three daughters right in the middle of it. It's super fun. I'm joking. They had all these babysitters, right, growing up, who are millennials. And many of them became friends in the way that, you know, good babysitters become friends. And basically part of my extended family. And those young women, you know, and there's maybe three or four or five of them, I've watched them grow from the age of like 19, now they're in their early 30s, and was sort of I wasn't exactly a mother, but I was like an older, like an aunt or something to these girls, and they would tell me what they were going through. And it was interesting because they went through all the same stuff that Generation X went through, but then they had this whole added element of everything being public and broadcast and shared instantly, Whereas you and I grew up and could make mistakes and get into trouble and not have it recorded and broadcast the next day, thank goodness. And so I, you know, I just feel enormous. So first of all, it was, you know, it was based on those few people that I knew really well and inspired by them. And then also just informed by this enormous sympathy that I have for that generation. I think they really kind of got the shaft. And that our generation was the last one to have a real childhood, you know, a real private space to make mistakes and learn and grow without feeling that you're being inspected at every moment. So hopefully the sympathy for them comes through.
Yeah, yeah. One thing that Nina loves, and it's a definitely a part of her story and that then becomes a part of the book, her love of planners. Tell me about Nina's love of planners and your decision to kind of weave that part of her and her life into the book itself.
Well, so I'm one of those people who loves the idea of being organized. And it's kind of an aspirational dream. Like I think I lie awake at night thinking, you know, things would be so much better if I had a really good system and I had a planner and I could, you know, block out the time I'm going to write and I could block out all the different things I need to do with the kids. And so I have this idea right in my head and it never, ever comes to pass. Like I have lots of planners that I have religiously filled out through January and put in everybody's birthdays and, you know, several days in a row sat down in the morning and planned my day. But then it falls apart. Like I'm just not a good, I'm not consistent with it. Nina is very consistent with her planner, and partly that relates to her anxiety. Like she gets quite, she's quite an anxious person, or she struggles with anxiety. And so being organized and having everything have a place and a time helps her feel in control. So it really becomes something that is sort of positively reinforcing for her. So she starts every day with her planner and she sits down and she thinks about her day. You know, now by the end of the day, she may have gone completely off the rails, and certainly over the course of the book, her life goes off the rails just because of a wide variety of things that happen to her. And the reason I include the planner pages throughout the book is because that was just another fun way to show her state of mind, you know, because you're seeing what she intends to do with the day. And then you read the chapter and you see what actually happened with the day. And so it's just a nice, I hope it's just a nice additional illustration. And it was also a nice cheat from a writer's point of view, because I was like, okay, new page, new chapter, here's the structure. And it gave me a structure for the book, which is something I struggle with as an author. I feel like structure is my weakness. So it was also a kind of a cheat.
That's a wonderful cheat, though. I would love to have a tool like that I could use, that because then it doesn't feel like outlining. This is part of the story structure, and this is Nina's doing. This isn't mine. You know, kind of a fun
right.
thing.
No, it's very. No, I'm a crafty bugger. No, it's definitely. it is definitely, and you can. It's in garden in the first book. I did it with the gardening classes, right? I would set up. You know, I had this structure that I created that gave like a skeleton to the book. And I really rely on it because I feel that's the thing I really struggle with as a writer. Characters I love to do, dialogue I love to do. I think I'm not great at description, and I think I suck at structure and plotting, or at least I think that's what I need to work on the most. That's the thing that always gives me the most challenge, and the thing I worry about the most when I'm writing. And so by cheating, is it cheating? I'm not sure if it's cheating or if it's just being creative.
It's being creative. Yeah.
It's being creative. So I had the gardening classes. And then in the second one, I had the day, you know, period time where they were taking the kids. Every so often I would have her take the kids to school, right? So there was always this repeated action that would happen. Because I think we actually do all have these things. We have, you know, some central point that is unchanging. You go to work or you have a weekly meeting with, I don't know, whoever one has a weekly meeting with, a nail technician, possibly, or, you know, a hairdresser, or, you know, you go and pick up the Sunday papers on a Sunday. So we all have these little markers, and so I just use them a lot to help me get through the writing process. The next one is about a mother and daughter taking a college tour, And I was eight, so that takes place over the course of a week, and I literally have an itinerary, and the book is currently called The Itinerary. So it's, you know.
I love it. Love
it. Definitely a habit.
Love it. One of the themes in this book that has really resonated deeply with me, in the last 6 months, I've lost both of my parents, and lots of family changes and things like that. And the idea in this book of a chosen family versus a biological family, and how those, you know, the people that you choose to surround yourself with are different than the people that you're born with, or are they? And you know, which one is more important? You know, or can there be one that's more important? What was going through your mind when you, you know, started to explore this idea of family and what makes family?
Well, I think that there were sort of two ideas came together in this book. The first was the character of Nina, and then the second was this idea of a broad extended family. I have a friend whose son is now, I think he's like 12, and her father married multiple times over the course of his life and married late in life and had children. And so her son has an uncle who is younger than him. And so I was always fascinated by that, by this idea that, you know, because of the way society works right now, you can have half brothers, half sisters, cousins, aunts, uncles, who are, you know, who broadly cover a large range of ages, who could be all over the country, could even be all over the world. Like, things are very scattered. So I was interested in that idea, and so I sort of brought the two together in the book. And as the child of divorce myself, and as someone whose father has been married multiple times, I've always been interested in the sort of, you know, the whole idea of blood is thicker than water. I'm just not convinced is actually the case. I think that that you can, if you have a family member who is not in any way constructive or helpful, you shouldn't necessarily feel forced to maintain that relationship just because you're related. And similarly, if you meet someone in your life who becomes like a sister to you, then that's really valid, you know, that you've made a choice that someone really is really important to you and they become family. And then I also see that in millennials, you know, many of them live far away from their families, and they choose a family. And there's sort of this whole concept of Friendsgiving and, like, you know, Palentine's Day and, like, all of these lovely phrases that they've come up with because they love to come up with names for things. But where they, you know, they choose their family. And I just think that's great. I think that making a choice to surround yourself with positive people or people who support the person that you want to be is really important. And sometimes your biological family isn't the best source of that.
Well, The Bookish Life of Nina Hill is out everywhere when you're hearing this. Abby, I love what you're doing. I absolutely love your writing. It's so evocative and provocative and wildly entertaining. If people are just learning about you and want to plug in with all that you do and dig into your back catalog and follow news and all that good stuff, is there a place where they can connect with you online?
Sure. I have a website, pardon me, abbywaxman.com, and they can connect to me through that, or they can reach me on Instagram is the best place to get me socially. Pardon me for coughing. And that is Abby Waxman, all one word. I'm on Instagram. So those are the two best places to reach me.
Fantastic. We will put links to the new book, The Bookish Life of Nina Hill, in the show notes, along with your social media and your website. Abby, thank you so much for taking time to come back on the show with me today.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure. I hope to see you again next year.
Thanks for tuning into the Author Stories podcast. Be sure to subscribe at hankgarner.com or on your favorite podcasting app. Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
I was walking through the woods between Wolfert's Roost and the future site of my father's stone manor house. The house would eventually stand on what had been old Baltus's pumpkin field, the land where I had found my grandfather's head. Father had chosen the spot for its view of the Hudson River. Knoll was to be a grand mansion in the Gothic Revival style, but at the time the mansion was but a few foundations of Van Brunt stone. I had become fond of the place already, the idea of it, and I spent many a night alone in a shack on the property. My mother disapproved. She would have me sleep in the room across from hers in our townhouse. But I was 15 and did not answer to her. I kept a bottle of spirits hidden in the crook of two walnut trees near old Baltus's grave. I thought he would approve of the gesture. I had stopped along my way to fetch it out. At the moment the first pull of liquor touched my throat, I heard a ghastly, inhuman laugh. I was not alone in the woods. Had God sent the horseman after me? Had I sinned that terribly? I ran through the wood and found the field where Knoll was to be built. The outline of the foundations was barely discernible beneath the snow. An apparition stood there. Though I have seen him many times since, I shall never forget my first glimpse. Gaunt in moonlight, headless, exuding power and malice. A magic thing in the land of the ordinary. The headless horseman of Sleepy Hollow. What chills those words evoke. It charged at me, hatchet raised. I stood transfixed, unable to move, unable to even imagine escape. This was the servant of God, after all, sent to strike down sinners. I hurled the bottle from my hand, ashamed that I had become a drunkard as Baltus had been. It shattered against the foundations of Knoll. I stretched out my arms and awaited judgment. A piercing white light broke the darkness. The horse reared.
"Not my Dillon!" cried Agatha,
appearing from the wood. She held a skull in her hand. It shone brightly as a diamond. And in that moment I understood. The horseman did not serve God. He served my grandmother. Perhaps in that moment I came to see Agatha and God as one and the same. The unholy spirit fought her command. A foreleg of the demon horse struck my head with such power that I fell backwards with a cry and knew no more. I carry the scar to this day. A slight indentation in my temple, barely noticeable. In my days of courting, I was told that when I am angry, the patch of insulted skull bone will stand out in a disturbing manner. I have never had occasion to see this phenomenon, however, as I am generally well pleased whenever I pass a mirror.